This is the Capital Literature Podcast, bringing you investment letters and audio. The Capital Literature Podcast is a CEBITS capital service for the investment community. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All rights belong to the respective owners.
Tolley Moore Investment Partners, Fourth Quarter, 2021. Part 3. A Letter to Partners, June 2019, The Rise of the Platform and Implications for Owners. Dear partners, many of our holdings are platform businesses or linear businesses with underappreciated emerging platform elements. We discuss below the rise of platform businesses, the challenges and benefits that are special to platforms, and the implications for equity owners. A History of Business Models. Since the Industrial Revolution, when the invention of machine tools and the development of steam power marked the transition from hand production to mechanized manufacturing processes, the industrial landscape has been characterized by linear business models. Linear businesses take inputs such as physical production assets and labor to make goods and services that are sold to customers, according to a linear, unidirectional value chain. Think car manufacturers, steel makers, and consumer goods companies. Distributors such as Walmart are also linear business models. In many cases, technological advancement has not changed the linear aspect of these companies' value chains. But in several industries, the internet has dramatically lowered distribution costs, permanently impairing capital in those industries that enjoyed economies of scale in physical distribution. Examples include travel agents, newspapers, encyclopedias, bookstores, video rental, and shopping malls. Businesses with high fixed costs of incremental production faced competition from companies enjoying negligible marginal costs of internet distribution. The transition that many software companies have made to recurring revenue SaaS models has been driven by the opportunity to lower the marginal cost of distribution and increase incremental returns on capital. But SaaS companies still operate a linear supply chain. Linear businesses create products and services using their internal resources and means of production. These internal means of production are a constraint on the sustainable growth of the business. What is a platform? A platform is a business model that facilitates interactions and the exchange of value between producers and consumers of something that is not produced by the platform itself. Rather than creating value by making and selling things, platforms provide a mechanism for exchange. As such, platforms are much less capital and labor intensive than linear businesses. Platforms generate revenues by capturing a share of the transaction value their network enables. Producers in a platform accept an additional cost of unit production in return for the larger volume opportunity that a platform affords. As such, platforms' break-even points tend to be at a larger scale than linear businesses. The economic characteristics of platforms. While the internet has lowered the costs of distribution for many businesses, platforms also have very low marginal costs of production, driving superior unit economics relative to linear businesses. Access to these superior economics is clearly desirable, but they are elusive. Building a successful platform necessitates solving a chicken and egg problem of having enough producers to attract consumers and vice versa. Without adequate scale and liquidity, the value to users will be lower than the cost of participation. It is this dynamic that makes platform businesses more difficult to build from a standing start versus their linear counterparts. Once past the tipping point at which user value is greater than the cost to participate, network effects can take hold to rapidly increase the peruser value of the network. In addition to network effects, successful platforms benefit from producer switching costs. Consumers provide non-monetary benefits to producers in the form of reviews, ratings, and other feedback such as likes and shares. This is an important mechanism encouraging good behavior and preserving required levels of customer service. As producers build up this goodwill asset, the costs of leaving the network and establishing a reputation from scratch increase. The challenges in building and protecting valuable platforms. One of the principal risks associated with linear business oligopolies is antitrust. The objective of antitrust is to promote fair competition for the benefit of consumers. Traditional monopolists control the means of production. They earn supernormal profits by restricting output, charging anti-competitive prices, and minimizing consumer surplus. Platform businesses do not own the means of production, but simply the means of connection. Platforms do not control the prices and outputs of producers. But by facilitating more touchpoints between consumers and producers, they can increase competition, to the ultimate benefit of the consumer. The goal to increase platform scale benefits both its owners and users. Platforms are therefore characterized by an alignment of interest between shareholders and customers that is not the case in traditional linear monopolists. A regulatory intention to curb a platform's dominance could have the undesirable effect of harming consumers' interests. Platforms make fragmented supply available to consumers in one place. Consider consumers wishing to find the best price for a hotel room. There is an opportunity cost associated with manually finding the owners of that inventory and comparing availability and pricing. Conducting that price comparison exercise on TripAdvisor is a more efficient process. And price transparency leads to a more competitive outcome for the consumer. The platform increases choice and saves the consumer time and money. And the more scale the platform has, the greater the choice, and the more competitive the price. In this way, platforms grow by delivering more value to their users, rather than by controlling the supply chain. However, while these academic considerations may be logical, until the regulatory regime evolves to be suitable for 21st century business models, incumbents will use arguably unfit for purpose antitrust frameworks to make life difficult for dominant platforms such as Airbnb and Uber. Implications for owners. Winner take most economic outcomes imply a race for scale, leading to potential battles for dominance. If access to financing is inadequate, or efforts to monetize the network are premature or clumsily executed, the platform may not acquire the requisite scale to enjoy the fruits of market dominance. With supportive owners, emerging platforms can avoid the pressure to generate short-term profits to maximize total long-term value creation. eBay entered China in the early 2000s and made the mistake of charging commissions to sellers immediately. By keeping Toubao free and by allowing buyers and sellers to communicate with each other, unencumbered by eBay's desire to prevent transactions outside of the network, Alibaba was able to grow its relevance and benefit from stronger network effects. Alibaba also introduced Alipay, which held customer cash in escrow accounts until buyers verified product receipt. We see parallels with the way in which Sea Limited is growing its ShopPay e-commerce platform in Southeast Asia. It is adopting a patient approach to monetizing its network in order to build non-replicable platform scale and liquidity. It is allowing suppliers and consumers to communicate with each other, and is overcoming trust hurdles with the ShopPay guarantee. ShopPay is also lowering the friction of e-commerce by integrating its AirPay business. Appraising addressable markets when the future does not equal the past. Aswath Damodaran, a respected finance professor at the Stern School of Business and considered an academic authority on company valuation, wrote a paper in 2014 in which he dismissed the private business value of Uber at the time of $17 billion. By making assumptions about Uber's potential market share and addressable market, which he defined as the global taxi industry, Professor Damodaran estimated Uber's value to be $5.9 billion. Bill Gurley, a partner at venture firm Benchmark, an Uber investor, published an article in response in which he contested that Damodaran had vastly underestimated Uber's addressable market. Gurley argued that Uber's potential market is greater than the taxi market due to a superior experience versus traditional taxis, cheaper, shorter pickup times, more convenient payment methods, greater safety and trust. As such, the relevant addressable market was not just the taxi industry, but included public transport, walking, rental cars and driving owned vehicles. Today Uber's market cap is $75 billion, more than four times the company's private business value 5 years ago. The outsized return on investment for Uber's owners was made available in part because of the market's failure to look beyond the incumbent industry in determining the prospects of those disrupting it. Airbnb is another prominent example of a platform which has expanded the addressable market for lodgings. It has opened an entirely new source of supply, spare rooms and empty homes, therefore growing largely through addressable market expansion rather than market share take. So addressable markets can be underappreciated due to a rigid appraisal of incumbent demand. They can also be underappreciated when there exists the potential to leverage the strength of the network to invest into adjacencies. Uber is leveraging the supply side of its network to expand into food delivery with Uber Eats. TripAdvisor is leveraging the demand side of its network to expand into attractions and restaurants. TripAdvisor has a rare opportunity to circumnavigate the chicken and egg problem associated with the development of strong platform business models by tapping into its existing demand in hotel and connecting it to acquired or developed supply in dining and experiences. For both restaurants and attractions, the number of reviewed items is multiples higher than the number of bookable items, and we expect low penetration rates of bookable inventory to provide a long volume growth runway. TripAdvisor is leveraging existing behaviors. People already book tickets to museums or visit famous landmarks and make restaurant reservations. But TripAdvisor is investing in an opportunity to reduce transaction friction by making it easier for customers to find, review and book restaurants and attractions. In doing so, it can bring vast untapped supply into its existing travel ecosystem. Crucially, this supply is large and fragmented, making its aggregation within a platform valuable. Valuing platforms. Perhaps the single biggest potential source of platform business undervaluation is the market's application of linear business prospects to a set of outcomes which could include exponential value growth. Linear businesses' customer acquisition efforts result in singular relationships per customer added. Recurring revenue business models may lower the cost of customer acquisition and retention, but they still result in a singular profit stream associated with each customer. When platforms acquire users, whether they are customers or producers, those users form relationships and transact with the existing users in the platform. As the number of users grows arithmetically, the number of potential relationships and interactions grows exponentially. And due to the very low marginal costs of distribution and production, profit margins can expand materially. The application of linear growth expectations to platform businesses therefore implies a failure of the platform to facilitate, nurture, and monetize these potential interactions. Once we understand the dramatically lower cost of growth for these businesses, we should question the relevance of previously accepted valuation methods. Over the last decade, MasterCard has compounded its earnings per share at 20% PA, and its share price has grown 30% PA. 10 years ago, MasterCard was available for sale at a mid-teen multiple of its per-share earnings. An investor could have paid 80 times the company's after-tax profits and still achieved an opportunity cost of investing of 10% per year for the next decade. The availability of this opportunity to public equity investors implies a dramatic underappreciation of the exponential growth properties of successful platform companies. Sotheby's, one of the world's most enduring platforms. We initially acquired our ownership of Sotheby's in May 2016 for $28.70 per share. In June 2019, Patrick Drahi announced the takeover of the company for $57 per share, and we sold our entire interest for $55.50 per share. The annualized gain of our exit price over our initial entry price was plus 24% per year, consistent with the annualized returns of the portfolio over that period. However, our ownership of Sotheby's has been the single largest contributor to Tullymore's cumulative investment results. Portfolio management is responsible for this outsized contribution. This is a pleasing outcome given our efforts to create an environment that allows us to execute a long-term investment program. Specifically, we have benefited from a setup that has allowed us to use share price volatility to lower our average cost of ownership. In doing so, we have shrunk the risk of permanent capital loss. Assuming an appropriate investment temperament and aligned investment partners, volatility is inversely correlated with risk. The volatility of publicly quoted securities drives our strong preference for public versus private market investing in the pursuit of acceptable and leveraged investment results. Sotheby's stock volatility has been driven to a greater degree by large changes in its earnings multiple rather than the variability of those earnings, potentially reflecting poor aggregate understanding of or conviction over what this company is worth on a long-term, through-cycle basis. Sotheby's business model embodies a wonderful combination: the provision of enduring services with very high barriers to profitable participation on the one hand, but the delivery of services which are subject to seasonal, cyclical, and otherwise unpredictable fluctuations on the other. The former allows us to benefit from the intrinsic value compounding of the underlying asset, while the latter affords us the scope to earn an equity return superior to that rate. Sotheby's is a 275-year-old global art business whose operations are organized under two segments: agency and finance. The agency segment earns commissions by matching buyers and sellers of authenticated fine art, decorative art, jewelry, wine, and collectibles through an auction or private sale process. The finance segment earns interest income from the provision of loans secured by works of art. This segment offers advances secured on consigned property as well as general purpose loans secured by property not presently intended for sale, less than 50% LTVs. Many traditional lending sources offer conventional loans at a lower cost to borrowers than the average cost of Sotheby's loans. Many traditional lenders also offer borrowers integrated financial services such as wealth management, which are not offered by Sotheby's. Few lenders, however, are willing to accept works of art as sole collateral. They lack access to market information required to effectively appraise underwriting risk. There is evidence of the presence of lasting unfair business advantages. Excluding the finance business, the core auction platform has generated historic returns on invested capital of 25-35%. Sotheby's and Christie's have had high and stable market shares for extraordinarily long periods of time. Sotheby's has pricing power. It charges sellers a circa 10% commission and a buyer's premium of 14-25% depending on the hammer price. However, in order to win larger or more prestigious consignments, Sotheby's and Christie's will often waive the seller commission, and sometimes even share the buyer's premium with the seller. This is effectively an investment in brand prestige and can be considered part of the cost of acquiring and retaining buyers and sellers. The finance segment is a form of captive financing which has earned mid-high teens returns on equity. What are the sources of this moat? Sotheby's business model enjoys barriers to entry facilitated by a duopoly competitive structure, two-sided network effects, a global brand that lowers search costs and elicits a higher level of trust and willingness to pay, and non-replicable heritage. Brand and reputation are arguably more valuable assets in the art market versus other industries due to the subjective, difficult-to-estimate value of the products being sold. Sotheby's duopoly with Christie's should allow the business more freedom to set pricing to maximize volume price equals revenues. Consignors are often the executors of estates who are responsible for monetizing illiquid assets with opaque and objective valuations. They typically have not consigned before and therefore their risk aversion attracts them to a global brand with a multi-century history and access to the highest quantity of relevant potential buyers. That is, unrivaled platform scale. The finance segment is an important ancillary business for Sotheby's. It helps to secure and grow client relationships. Sotheby's has a clear collateral liquidity and underwriting advantage versus traditional lenders unable to take artwork as loan security. Most global art transactions are private sales, but Sotheby's and Christie's account for more than a third of global auction sales, and 80% of auction sales priced higher than $1 million. Smaller competitors such as Phillips and Bonhams have been unable to weaken the dominance of the big two and penetrate the market for the most valuable works. Changes in the buyer's premium enacted by one auction house have typically been followed in both directions by the other. Arguably, Sotheby's long-term value creation has been lower than one would expect from such a demonstrably wide moat business. This could be due to value accruing to executives rather than shareholders and a reluctance from prior management to make long-term investments into the business, and/or excessive discounting in order to win high-profile consignments. One could argue that Sotheby's stagnant profits over the years reflect a failure to exploit the considerable increase in the number of individuals with the financial means to purchase expensive art. Relatively flat global art market sales over the last decade seem at odds with the trebling of wealth owned by the globe's billionaires over the same period. Since Tad Smith has taken the helm in 2015, the company has made good progress on capital allocation, scrapping the dividend and making significant stock repurchases at depressed prices, and on investing in digital capabilities and product adjacencies to improve overall SVA of this business. However, little ground seems to be made on employee cost efficiencies, and it is disappointing that the company has altogether stopped reporting some of the metrics relevant to these goals. When we initially invested, we identified some opportunities to improve return on operating expenses. Travel and entertainment costs were $17,000 per employee, professional fees were more than $50 million PA, the average employee salary was almost $190,000, and management outlined its expectation for mid-single-digit declines in headcount. Unfortunately, there is limited financial evidence to suggest that any headway has been made in lowering the fixed costs of doing business. Headcount has continued to increase, average employee costs have risen by 2% per year, and Sotheby's stopped disclosing several of the above metrics from 2Q 2017. Nonetheless, there is evidence to suggest that the future economic value that Sotheby's will generate for owners will be larger than historically has been the case due to 1. The development of ancillary revenue streams outside of the core auction, and 2. The digitization of the delivery of Sotheby's services. Ancillary revenue development. Private sales are a low proportion of Sotheby's revenues today. In 2018, Sotheby's generated $1 billion of private sales, a 75% increase in 2 years, but still just 16% of consolidated sales. Private sales may be preferred by consignors wishing to preserve anonymity, seeking to minimize costs of the sale, to test an aspirational price hidden from the public eye, or to avoid the publicity of a failed sale. The advantage of an auction is the competitive bidding tension created, and the potential for auction dynamics to lead to irrational bidding strategies to the ultimate benefit of the seller. Endowment effect, social proof and scarcity are all at play. There may be an opportunity for Sotheby's to leverage its relationships with consignors and buyers, and its access to data and valuation expertise, to capture a higher share of private sales, still the dominant mechanism for settling art transactions. CEO Tad Smith has outlined his goal of building enough understanding of customers' preferences to allow Sotheby's to offer unsuccessful auction bidders the opportunity to buy similar items via a private sale within 24 hours of the auction. Sotheby's recruited David Schrader from J.P. Morgan in 2017 to lead a dedicated team with the goal of growing private sales business. We would suggest that Sotheby's is well positioned versus private dealers and art galleries in facilitating private art transactions between buyers and sellers given the breadth of its customer relationships, collection of transaction data and ability to offer advisory and financing services. There are opportunities outside of art too. Sotheby's already sells furniture, jewelry, wine, cars and watches, and is expanding further. These items are often the gateway into the purchase of works of art. Service digitization. The digital delivery of services could make the art market more accessible and lower the costs of doing business. The company is seeing record numbers of new bidders, two-thirds of whom are bidding online. Online-only sales are generating just 4% of total revenues but are responsible for one-third of new customer additions to the company's database. Art e-commerce growth materially lags retail e-commerce growth. Digitization is strengthening the network and is creating the potential for an acceleration in revenue and profit growth by increasing the accessibility of Sotheby's services and the competitiveness of its auctions of unique objects, fixed supply and growing demand. Sotheby's capacity to access untapped international demand also improves as it increasingly conducts its business online. 3/4 of revenues are generated in NYC and London, yet art has global appeal. The slowness of art sales to migrate online over the years may be a function of the presence of asymmetric information and value of physical inspection. These do not seem to be surmountable challenges for a business with Sotheby's credibility, valuation advisory resources and increasingly technological solutions to verifying authenticity. The opportunity is reflected in a world in which millennials represent one-third of HNW collectors. Digital service delivery lowers physical venue dependency, requires less travel and less paper processing, including catalog production. Technology lowers the labor intensity of art authenticity evaluation, sourcing consignments, matching buyers and sellers, and valuation. Capital allocation and incentive structures are improving. Tad Smith reduced the share count for the first time in 10 years. Management incentives are now linked to ROIC, a KPI that was not even mentioned in prior proxy materials. Smith's future stock awards were linked to high stock price hurdles. The share price had to at least reach $85 by 2020 for him to receive the maximum award. Competitive discipline seems to be improving. Inventory sales fell by half in 2018, generating most of the operating margin improvement from 16% to 19%, and perhaps suggesting that the company has been more disciplined in its use of auction guarantees. When we initially acquired shares in 2016, margins had collapsed driven partly by a spike in auction guarantees, the poor judgment of which led to a loss on inventory sales. Management has shown a willingness to invest for the long term. Management has demonstrated an understanding of the company's unfair business advantages and has deployed capital to strengthen these. Acquisitions over the last 3 years include the May Moses Art Indices, recognized as the preeminent measure of the state of the art market. Previously publicly available, this is now an internal asset. Ryan Analytical, a scientific research firm which has developed technologies and procedures to verify authenticity. Art Agency Partners, a consulting firm advising art collectors on portfolio strategies and philanthropic matters connected with the arts. Thread Genius, an AI startup which has developed algorithms to identify objects and recommend similar images to viewers. Sotheby's has been developing an object database which is designed to physically locate objects of interest and match buyers and sellers. In 2018, Sotheby's was able to spend $300 million repurchasing shares, almost triple capital investments, and lower its leverage ratio. It did this while delivering a 24% return on shareholders' capital. This is a very good business. We also thought it was a very cheap business. Sotheby's trailing 12-month EBITDA of $200 million is broadly in line with its 10- and 15-year averages, an 8% yield to the quoted enterprise value prior to the acquisition. This was the price of a business with a wide, and widening, moat, for which the costs of doing business could decline, for which corporate governance and incentive structures have improved, and with several paths to profitable revenue growth, including the digital democratization of art, increasing auction competitiveness, and taking market share in private sales. Final thoughts. Tollymore is a multi-decade learning effort. Striving for self-awareness and sound judgment guides our decision-making every day. We are grateful for our relationships with intellectually generous peers and investment partners. These help to compound knowledge and improve our chances of becoming just a little bit wiser together, day by day. Thank you for your partnership. A letter to partners, September 2019, Incentives, Wealth, and Happiness. Dear partners, Tollymore's mission. Tollymore's first investment letter to partners stated that its objectives were to 1. Create value in an industry that in aggregate transfers value from investors to managers, and 2. Create a flexible lifestyle in which there is no distinction between work and play. In a way in which business and investment success are determined by productivity, relationships, serendipity, and personal energy. It is this flexible way of living which facilitates a commitment to the happiness of Tullymore's principals, their family, and the delight of the firm's investment partners on a multi-decade basis. The goal here is to secure sustainable freedom. Underlying such freedom is the permission to make decisions in the interests of creating value for those whose lives Tullymore influences. That is, the investment partners of the firm, and the friends and family of those individuals who are the firm. The really important kind of freedom involves attention, and awareness, and discipline, and effort, and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them, over and over, in myriad petty little unsexy ways, every day. David Foster Wallace. Is the accumulation of personal wealth consistent with this goal? To the extent that personal financial progress may allow one to free up more time to devote to the interests of the meaningful people in our lives, it may seem like an important ingredient in achieving Tullymore's goals. Yet there is ample, hardly undiscovered, evidence questioning the correlation between wealth and happiness. Specifically relating to the investment management endeavor, a money manager's personal objective to maximize her own personal wealth may be harmful to the prospects of creating the most aggregate dollars of value for the investment firm's owners and investors. This is because investment management, in its most widely practiced form, is extremely scalable. In its most widely practiced form, there exist strong incentives to gather assets, scaling revenues without commensurate increases in the costs of dispensing fiduciary responsibilities and exercising sensible investment and business judgment. These incentives include managers not invested in the funds they manage, high management fees, no performance fees, and opacity regarding the appropriate benchmark for complex strategies, and therefore an inability to measure the manager's capacity to create value. An asset growth imperative is compounded by large and expensive teams and bloated, gold-plated cost structures designed to convey institutional suitability. More generally, wealth can be a distraction. This observation places no judgment on how financially successful people choose to enjoy the fruits of their success. But such enjoyment may create a conflict of interest with those who help create it, and to whom there remains an ongoing responsibility to deliver acceptable results. An investment manager may become distracted by the enjoyment or redistribution of the prosperity he has acquired as the owner of an investment management business. This may be through the obvious channel of consumerism. Yachts, private jets, property and luxury travel acquired in increasing doses via hedonic adaptation, but also through more laudable, philanthropic avenues. This is not an opinion of the devotion of capital to charitable projects. But the commitment of time to philanthropic causes could be a distraction from the business of money management. This industry is hard enough for those dedicating their entire working existence to the pursuit of investment outperformance. This is not to say that wealth is an undesirable outcome, nor that its pursuit is not worthwhile. Indeed, the objective to create substantial personal wealth may well contribute to higher life satisfaction. But, 1, the benefit of wealth as an outcome is often overstated, and, 2, the pursuit of individual wealth may be at the expense of more likely contributors to happiness. Addressing these in turn. Process versus outcomes in the wealth-happiness correlation. There is evidence to suggest that the method of wealth acquisition is an important determinant in the happiness associated with such wealth. People whose prosperity has been earned, versus won or inherited have reported higher levels of life satisfaction. There are also studies to suggest that altruism is linked to more enduring versions of reported happiness than, for example, the purchase of experiences. That is, people who are emotionally and behaviorally compassionate enjoy greater well-being, happiness, health, and longevity. One of the reasons for this is the connection to others' altruistic behavior empowers. This self-serving benefit of empathetic behavior highlights the question over whether true altruism exists. The observation that altruistic acts are self-interested was most profoundly underlined by one of the greatest philosophers of the 1990s, Joey from Friends. After Phoebe deliberately allows herself to be stung by a bee so it can look cool in front of its bee friends, Joey explains that the bee probably died as a result, and concludes that there are no selfless good deeds. An extension of these observations might suggest the accumulation of personal capital through a working life dedicated to creating value for others versus transferring value from others, is more likely to lead to greater happiness. We seek non-zero-sumness, or symbiotic value chains, in the small selection of companies in which we invest, and in the relationships with the small number of investment partners whose capital we manage alongside our own. The role of relationships in leading a good life. A good life is a life that feels good to live, a worthwhile life of progress, achievement, enjoyment and engagement, and above all, with good relationships at its heart. A.C. Grayling. One of the most treasured virtues of Tullymore is the freedom it allows its principals to think independently. Nonetheless, humans are social animals. We function better in communities rather than in isolation. Studies suggest our mental health and well-being are connected to the quality of our relationships. This involves nourishing valuable connections and minimizing or removing negative associations. Tullymore is a multi-decade effort to build and sustain trusted relationships with long-term investment partners. Great investment partners are a competitive advantage. An evolving, mutually appreciative and increasingly resilient relationship is an enabler of greater and more sustainable value creation. An important dimension of successful investment management organizations. True of great organizations in many fields, is having great clients. If you have clients you do not enjoy or admire, or clients that do not expect much of you, you should seriously consider terminating the relationship with them. They will hold you back. If you have great clients, wonderful clients, reach out to them and ask them to demand even more of you. The great role of the client is to challenge you to be the very best that you can be. Charles Ellis, The Characteristics of Successful Investment Firms. There is a natural alignment between an investor with a long-term, possibly perpetual, investment horizon, and a younger, emerging, investment management organization. As the manager ages and the fund matures, this alignment may be challenged if the manager's personal investment objectives become more influenced by preservation versus growth. Assuming good health and sound mind, Tullymore's investment runway is 30 to 40 years. But a recognition of this potential future misalignment is important. As is a willingness to work with investment partners whose missions outlast the biological constraints of the investment firm's owners, in order to think about succession or other safeguards. Several aspects of Tullymore's investment and business process are designed with this goal to engender meaningful and valuable relationships in mind. A balance sheet and a cost structure that enables us to adopt a patient approach to building these relationships. Transparent and candid investor communication acts as a filter for investors who can think unconventionally and act countercyclically. Incentive structures which make it more sensible to forego additional management fees in lieu of excess returns on insider capital. Frameworks for economic profit sharing which reward acceptable performance and coordinate manager and investor enrichment. These include the employment of hurdles to make weak performance cheap and strong performance expensive. Tullymore's new fee structure. Over the last few months, we have reappraised the consistency of Tullymore's business principles with the objective of non-zero-sumness. As a result, we are introducing a fee structure for investors who invest a minimum of £1 million of net contributed capital, and who agree to commit that capital for a minimum period of 3 years. For these investors, Tullymore will offer a choice of fee structures as follows. 1% management fee and 10% of any investment returns above a 5% hurdle or 1% management fee and a 20% performance fee above a benchmark return, the MSCI All Country World Index, USD. The rationale, we want to ensure that investors receive most of any outperformance generated, not just most of the absolute return. As such, we want to offer a fee structure that allows us to talk about integrity with some legitimacy. Too many managers charge egregious fees with the sole purpose of enriching themselves at the expense of clients. A benchmark hurdle has not been part of the original fee structure due to Tullymore's benchmark agnosticism and absolute return remit. However, we recognize it is the opportunity cost for many investors. A benchmark hurdle is an elegant solution to ensuring that investors receive the majority of any alpha generated. The fixed hurdle is an option for those investors not wishing to pay fees in a year in which Tullymore generates negative results which are superior to the benchmark. The fixed hurdle is also lower than one might expect the very long-run performance of a global benchmark to be. Grubhub Incorporated, profiting from lazy journalism. Narrative fallacy and the Murray Gell-Mann amnesia effect. For part of my career, I was a sell-side equity research analyst. I was a specialist covering pan-European telecoms companies. And as a specialist, I remember reading newspaper articles relating to the telco sector in respected business broadsheets and feeling that the journalism was often subjective, unsubstantiated and shallow. Often it was factually spurious. I would then turn the page to read an article about some other sector outside of my specialism, and afford it much higher trustworthiness than the telco piece. Michael Crichton gave this a name, the Murray Gell-Mann amnesia effect. Serious media publications invent stories to explain outcomes, without the resources or inclination to determine causality. This often manifests itself in major descriptive U-turns as the outcome changes with the wind. the matters about which financial and political journalists opine are complex. This limits the mechanism to scrutinize these stories and hold their authors to account. And there is value to their readers and listeners, who can paraphrase talking heads' memorable soundbites at cocktail parties rather than acknowledging ignorance or retrieving the relevant facts from their addled brains. Authority bias plays a role. Media appearance confers credibility, the belief in which is counter to independent thought and self-awareness. Unsubstantiated conjecture is rife. As Mr. Crichton puts it, one problem with speculation is that it piggybacks on the gelman effect of unwarranted credibility, making the speculation look more useful than it is. The goal of epistemic humility is consistent with maintaining a careful distance from today's media. To exercise good judgment, we should shield ourselves from the gelman effect. Financial markets, political and economic systems, unlike meteorology, are reflexive. Participants are second-guessing one another, and the basis on which decisions are made are altered by the decisions themselves. Speculation thrives because it is cheap and speculators are not held to account, but forecasting is foolish when nobody knows the future. Narrative fallacy is the backward-looking mental drive to attribute a cause and effect chain to our knowledge of the past. Without searching for reasons, we would go around with blinders on, one thing simply happening after another. This helps us make sense of the world despite sensory overload. However, it can cause us to make poor decisions. The power of narrative causes us to violate probabilities and logic. Tollymore seeks to profit from the narrative fallacy by specifically seeking out stocks without good stories, or those with bad stories. Grub, negative stories create opportunity. We purchased an equity interest in Grubhub, GRUB, during the quarter. Grub provides a marketing service to restaurants to help them generate takeaway orders. The company does this via an online and mobile platform connecting 125,000 local restaurants with 20 million active diners wishing to order takeaway food, either pickup or delivery, in 2.4K cities across the US. The company was founded in 2004 and listed in 2014. The restaurant proposition is the generation of higher margin takeaway orders at full menu prices. The diner proposition is a more satisfactory and less error-prone. Mechanism versus paper menus and telephone ordering. More choice, more convenience, better informed decisions. Traditional offline takeaway ordering is the principal source of competition. That is, the dollars that most restaurants direct to paper menus and local advertisements. The largest marketplace and delivery competitors are DoorDash, Uber Eats, and Postmates. The following quotes sum up the prevailing press commentary on Grub's business progress in recent times. Grubhub posted its best revenue growth in 4 years in the third quarter, but it also reported increased expenses, particularly in marketing, suggesting competition is finally heating up. Grubhub is relying on partnerships to counter competition from the likes of DoorDash and Uber Eats. Grubhub once owned close to 70% market share as recently as 2017, but extreme competition has caused it to dwindle. Battleground in the escalating competition for dominance. As competition increases, Grubhub has had to boost its advertising and promotional spending to compete. Grubhub has responded to increased competition with marketing campaigns and technology updates, which has cut into margins. The implied causality between higher spending and higher competition is unsubstantiated. There is little evidence for this in the form of higher customer acquisition costs, which have remained stable. Rather, the company's accelerated spending in recent quarters has resulted in strong acceleration in customer growth, with net additions running at treble their historic rates. To refute the ill-evidenced claims of lazy journalism requires no special insight, insider knowledge, nor proprietary analysis. But the acknowledgement of publicly available information has led us to a different conclusion, which is that this seems to be far from a zero-sum situation. Despite the entrance of well-capitalized rivals such as DoorDash and Uber Eats, Grub's diner churn has not been affected. Grub's quarterly food sales growth is accelerating. The attrition rate of restaurants leaving the platform has also not changed in several years, and diner retention rates continue to improve. Amazon closed its meal ordering and delivery business Amazon Restaurants in the summer of 2019, after 4 years of failing to build profitable scale. Rationality is a superpower. Tollymore is charged with applying logic to anomalies. In our view, the objective investment merits of Grub are compelling, and are at odds with the prevailing narrative concerning the company's prospects. Grub enjoys lasting unfair business advantages which we expect to protect the company's discretionary profits. Barriers to profitable participation in this industry emanate primarily from two-sided network effects. That is, a marketplace connecting restaurants with diners. This is a platform that can create considerable value due to fragmented supply. One-sided network effects are also present in the form of user reviews. Grubb has invested in the expansion of the two-sided network via marketing dollars and business acquisitions. The merger with Seamless in 2013, for example, allowed the company connect Grubb's diners with more restaurants. Grubb's value proposition extends beyond diner acquisition and food delivery. The LevelUp acquisition is an example of investment directed to deepening the level of service integration between the restaurant and the platform. But Grubb also provides 24/7 access to support staff. Grubb tracks restaurant performance on the platform and helps restaurants to manage capacity and adequately resource demand fluctuations, and to price to maximize takeaway revenues. As the platform grows, we could expect that brand and product awareness grows, lowering diner and restaurant acquisition costs as word of mouth and reverse solicitation replace marketing efforts in the generation of business leads. Grubb enjoys an incumbent advantage. Restaurants do not wish to partner with many digital food delivery platforms. Dealing with 5 different partners and operating 5 different tablets and systems becomes cumbersome and unappealing. They are likely to have partnerships with a small number of platforms. Grubb has an opportunity to redeploy discretionary profits into value-accretive activities. The takeaway market in the U.S. is $250 billion, almost 50x Grubb's gross food orders. If Grubb has about a third of the market, the total digital penetration is still in the single digits. Then there is the very real possibility that the current takeaway industry underestimates the addressable market if digital food ordering platforms take share from grocery stores and home cooking. In 2015, for the first time, Americans spent more money at restaurants than at grocery stores. Food service locations account for 40% of all new leases in Manhattan, more than clothing stores, banks, and health clubs combined. In 2020, more than half of restaurant spending is projected to be off-premise. This off-premise spending is projected to account for 80% of the industry's growth in the next 5 years. While the annual cost of customer support and payment processing fees is unlikely to be meaningfully scalable, the principal source of Grubb's capital intensity is technology and software, which is scalable. A quarter of operating expenditure is directed to sales and marketing activities and primarily focused on growing existing assets, monetizable restaurant and diner relationships. Significant portions of cost are directed at growth investments, 95% of sales and marketing according to management. And at the end of 2018, Grubb spent more on advertising than it ever has in the past. On the FY17 conference call, management stated that after stripping out overhead and only including direct costs such as customer service and credit card processing fees, the company's profit per order equals $3.40, much higher than the current reported EBITDA per order of $1.23. There will always be some maintenance, tech, and marketing requirements to service existing business operations. But the gulf between these two numbers highlights the reinvestment rates of the business. At $3.40 per order, Grubb's 2018 EBITDA would be $540 million, a 10% yield to the current enterprise value. The press speculation around margin compression and competition have contributed to an erosion of 2/3 of Grubb's market quotation over the last year, creating a compelling opportunity for long-term investors capable of making purchase decisions on the basis of very positive and possible long-term outcomes, but in the face of near-term uncertainty and media noise. Thank you for your partnership. A letter to partners, December 2019. 3 decisions. Dear partners, it is our view that fund managers must have the capacity and freedom to repeatedly make the choice between averaging down and acknowledging mistakes when confronted with quoted price declines. We made 3 portfolio management decisions over the course of the year which we believe will set the course of our long-term investment results on a higher trajectory. The small number of investment choices worth discussing is consistent with our comfort with inaction, and our conviction in the merits of making only occasional and sensible portfolio decisions in the interests of maximizing long-term investment results. We encourage partners to use these decisions to judge the consistency of our actions and words, in order to interrogate the faithfulness of our investment program to the stated philosophy. TripAdvisor. When I'm wrong, I change my mind. What do you do? John Maynard Keynes. We initiated a position in Trip in September 2016 for $61. We sold our final shares in the business in November 2019 for $32. Over the duration of our holding, Trip has had the largest weighting of any stock, averaging 12.8% of assets under management. Despite the large difference between the initial acquisition price and the final sale price, Trip has detracted only very slightly from Tolymore's cumulative results. The average purchase price was $44 and the average sale price $43. While reasonable portfolio management mitigated the potential for permanent dollar impairment of partners' assets, we have, of course, suffered a significant opportunity cost of investing in Trip. and we have made fundamental errors of judgment from which we seek to learn. Trip makes money by generating traffic, converting that traffic into a monetizable event, an advertising lead or booking, and charging an auction-based price for such conversion. We saw a significant monetization opportunity given the huge global influence Trip has on billions of travel decisions globally, and the low customer acquisition costs Trip enjoys as a result of its trusted, top-of-funnel brand. The company saw this opportunity too. Management embarked on multiple methods of stemming the company's economic leakage, from instant book to media advertising. While these initiatives depressed near-term operating results, we contended they were sensible efforts to materially improve the company's long-run earning potential. What really excited us about Trip was the potential to connect existing demand, 500 million unique monthly visitors, to acquired or developed supply in adjacent verticals, experiences and dining. In so doing, Trip could leapfrog the chicken and egg problem associated with nascent platform business models. We remain excited about this potential. However, our enthusiasm for the prospects of Trip's hotels business has waned. With hindsight, we were the proverbial boiling frog in recognizing the escalating challenges faced in the core Meta business. We underestimated, 1, the declining utility of Meta to consumers, and, 2, the size of the advantage afforded to Google as a result of being positioned just a few inches closer to the consumer. Trip's 3Q19 earnings report highlighted an accelerated decline in hotel Meta revenues, predominantly because of Google siphoning off high-margin SEO traffic. That is, encouraging customers to click on its own hotel Meta links and pushing organic results from Trip, Booking.com and Expedia further down the page. Exp doesn't seem to feature on the first page of Google at all nowadays. This is an issue that Trip CEO Steve Coffer has highlighted before. Google has rebuilt the front end of its Meta product from scratch and has strongly increased review volumes and user engagement, although still far behind Trip. What are the competitive implications of this? We think Trivago, Trip's most like-for-like pure-play Meta peer, will have a very hard time surviving Google's tactics. As discussed, Trip has other business adjacencies and revenue opportunities such as media, experiences and dining that continue to report encouraging progress. Trip's investment dollars are being increasingly directed outside of the branded hotels business, into the E&D platforms and media advertising opportunities. To this end, they recruited Lindsay Nelson as Chief Experience Officer. This seems to be a very critical hire in determining the company's ability to turn shots on goal into actual goals with regards to monetizing Trip's global influence. The latest rendition of these efforts seems to be a dawning that Trip is a media company which is seriously under-indexing versus its reach and engagement. Google's actions may accelerate antitrust efforts. Only 40% of Google searches now result in a click to a non-Google site. In congressional hearings, Google has refused to adhere to its original goal to get you out of Google and to the right place as fast as possible. A move to a mission statement around helping you get things done has been underway for around 5 years now. But our appraisal of the quality of Trip's Meta business was off the mark. We had always assumed that it was not necessary for Trip to take a monopolistic economic share of the digital migration of travel decisions and advertising dollars for its equity to be a great investment. We considered Trip part of a global duopoly in hotel Meta. And in our view, the principal competitor to Trip's product offering was the large portion of travel bookings and advertising still taking place offline. But we were too dismissive of the value that Google commands by being right at the top of the funnel for most hotel booking experiences. From this position, Google has the power to inflate OTA and Meta companies' customer acquisition costs by replacing their organic results with ads or Google's own inventory occupying the most valuable top-of-page real estate. It was also our contention that OTA's efforts to spend their way into a closer relationship with the traveler were unlikely to represent a permanent shunning of Meta investments. This was because consumers care about price, especially for homogeneous inventory. As the inventory owner, OTAs and hotels can only offer one price. Thus, we perceived Meta companies' capacity to scrape the internet for hundreds of prices as an enduring utility that was impossible to replicate by those further down the funnel. We also like the fragmented supply in hotel Meta search, unlike, for example, flight Meta search. As such, we applauded management's effort to educate its users about Trip's price comparison capability. However, over the last decade there has been steady OTA consolidation, putting Meta companies' claims that they compare hundreds of prices on shaky ground. It also makes for a less competitive auction, lowering achievable prices per click that have never been in Trip's direct control. If Meta is a business in secular decline, Trip's prospects may be determined by goodco./badco. Dynamics in which the plateau of the core business causes revenue growth to stagnate, but then accelerate as the goodco becomes an increasing part of the mix. The branded hotels business generates c. $300 million of EBITDA. If this profit stream were to decline by 10% per year consistently, it would be worth $1.5 billion to an investor with a 10% opportunity cost. This is conservative as only a significant minority of the hotel's Meta business is free SEO traffic. That would leave the rest of the business valued at $2 billion. Management expects display revenues to double in the next 3 to 5 years. This should be very high incremental margin revenue. And we think the normal margin of the E&D business is circa 40%, more fragmented supply and less loyal demand than hotels. If we apply 40% margin to the display and E&D revenues, the maintenance EBITDA of that business is $230 million, valuation 8-9x normal EBITDA. Even assuming a perpetual decline in its Meta revenues, the group can still grow at mid-single-digit rates with operating leverage and a capital-light business model. But the investment proposition has changed. Trip's profitable future now lies in its ability to monetize its traffic at the research phase, i.e. further down the funnel via media advertising, as well as building its experiences and dining offering. As such, Trip's investment merits pale in comparison to Tullymore's other holdings, and so we exited our long-standing investment dispassionately. Wonderful Sky Financial Group. Wonderful Sky, WSFG, stock continued to strongly underperform global markets in 2019. In each of the last 2 years, its quoted price has lagged the MSCI equity by more than 40% in GBP. Throughout our ownership of the business, we have purchased additional shares at lower prices. WSFG is comfortably the largest detractor from Tullymore's cumulative results. In our 2 year ownership, our average purchase price was $1.22 versus the current share price of HK$0.65. We haven't sold any shares. Before we delve into the investment merits, a thought experiment. What should the enterprising business investor be willing to pay for a simple owner-operated business which has a long history of dominating its niche, has generated 19% annualized revenue growth over the last decade to circa 600 million HKD today, a majority of which is recurring in nature, and average net income margins of circa 35%? Would you accept this business as a gift? What if the owner not only offered you this business for free, but also offered you more than 100 million HKD in cash to own it? That is the price available to investors today in the public equity markets. WSFG is a Hong Kong-based financial PR firm founded in 1996. WSFG manages corporate disclosure responsibilities and shareholder and professional investment community relations for corporate clients. Typically, after being engaged for a corporate finance activity, listing, fundraising or merger/acquisition, WSFG will act as the vehicle for communications with investors and media. Specifically, WSFG engages in media monitoring and media relations management, press release and speech writing, design and production of corporate marketing materials, shareholder identification and investor targeting, events coordination, international roadshow logistics support, design of investor relations websites and financial printing. WSFG's value proposition is creating a positive perception of the company client, or overcoming negative publicity, helping clients to improve their stock price and obtain favorable financing terms. This is a labor-intensive, capital-light business. Operating leverage is moderate. Perhaps 30% of costs can be considered fixed, although staff costs are stepped fixed costs. In 2019, global IPO deal numbers declined 19%, while proceeds fell by 4%, potentially as a result of global trade tensions. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange has consistently ranked number one in the world for funds raised through IPOs, and currently constitutes almost one-fifth of global IPO proceeds. Last year was no exception, with 154 IPOs raising a total of $38 billion in 2019, Hong Kong ranked first among global exchanges by deal numbers and proceeds. Notwithstanding local political and social uncertainty, the pipeline also seems strong, more than 168 companies having submitted their A1 filings to HKEX. Capital markets activity is cyclical, but WSFG's services for both IPO and non-IPO clients help to mitigate the impact of capital markets downturns. The proportion of revenues generated from recurring sources versus IPO/project work has increased from half to two-thirds in recent years. WSFG is the clear market leader in the world's largest IPO market, consistently assisting 70-90% of the largest firms listing. This dominant position is the result of a quarter of a century of experience providing financial PR services in Hong Kong, over which time it has accumulated a track record and reputation, as well as a network of clients and counterparty relationships. The post-IPO market is more fragmented, but WSFG is still the clear market leader, thanks to extremely high post-IPO retention rates. Customer price inelasticity suppresses customer acquisition costs. Financial PR and IR fees are a small percentage of overall funds raised but are crucial to the successful execution of the IPO, which only happens once. Deviating from the market leader is a risk seemingly not worth taking, either by the corporates being listed or the other service providers who daren't risk their own reputations by recommending a PR firm other than the dominant market leader with the longest and most successful delivery history. This lowers customer price sensitivity and allows IPOs to serve as a starting point for building longer-term relationships. Accumulated expertise, relationships, and WSFG's integrated offering are all likely to contribute to switching costs which have preserved the company's excellent financial track record. The growth potential of financial PR services in the region is highlighted by HKEX's own expansion strategy. According to its strategic plan 2019-2021, the HK Stock Exchange expects to expand into the PRC. China's onshore capital markets continue to internationalize, driving increasing flows of global liquidity into China. We will provide international investors with the most comprehensive range of Chinese securities investments. China's market cap to GDP ratio is 0.8x, versus 1.2x for Japan, and 1.7x for the USA, despite enjoying considerably higher economic growth. Hong Kong has several advantages over mainland China as a listing destination, including less onerous listing requirements and a more trusted legal system. As a result, Hong Kong has consistently raised more IPO funds than Shanghai/Shenzhen. Liu Tiani is the CEO and founder of WSFG. He owns 2/3 of the equity and has never sold a share, including when the company listed in 2012. High dividend payout ratios of circa 60% have been a prominent feature of Mr. Liu's capital allocation strategy but were recently cut to purchase the company's office building, and as a response to recent IPO market weakness. With a net cash balance of circa 900 million HKD and a quoted market cap of circa 775 million HKD, the market now values this business at minus 125 million HKD. While part of WSFG's stock decline has been due to macro uncertainty, social unrest and a volatile IPO market, we have also constructively engaged with management to address the business's overly conservative capital payout policies and a suboptimal capital structure. There is conservative capital allocation, and there is irrational capital allocation. If WSFG generated zero earnings forever, it could still afford to pay 100 million HKD in dividends for almost a decade. Assuming the business can sustain, but never grow, its current, depressed, earnings, it could pay 100 million HKD per annum and cash balances would still increase by 100 million HKD greater than plus 10% With a 50% payout ratio, it would have 1 billion HKD of cash and investments on the balance sheet next year. And this would grow every year without any earnings growth. This is an extraordinary valuation anomaly, the unwinding of which we expect to be most valuable to our investment partners. Grubhub. We discussed in detail the reasons behind our purchase of Grub shares in our September 2019 letter to partners. In short, we believe the business scores very highly across the core aspects of business quality we seek in holding companies: a simple business, soundly financed, strong track record, well-positioned to defend and grow intrinsic value over time, and thoughtfully stewarded. We are conscious that Grub is a heavily shorted stock that divides investment opinion. This is neither something we seek nor shun in our investments. Regardless of others' thoughts of the companies we own, our decisions to own them are made independently, after conducting research calmly in a quiet room and, we hope, based on objective information and insights. Emotionally bashing or defending stocks on investment forums and social media is a waste of cognitive energy at best. In addition, it seems likely to introduce hurdles such as commitment bias into decision-making. A few weeks after we initiated our position, the company released its third-quarter results, accompanied by a letter from management which sent the stock down 43% in a single day. The vitriol from short sellers and the financial press was deafening. The letter detailed a slowdown in order growth as a result of diner promiscuity, leading to a reset of long-run industry growth expectations. Diner trends began to change in August, when orders per customer trended lower than expected. This is particularly true for newer customers in newer markets. As a result, the letter noted that many of the supply innovations have played out and that the industry is returning to a more normal long-term state, which we believe will settle in the low double digits, except that there are multiple players all competing for the same new diners and order growth. Diners also appear to be less loyal to individual platforms. The lower diner loyalty that Grub has seen since August seems to imply that the LTVs of new customers deteriorated in the few months prior. As a result of these observations, management decided to accelerate investment into restaurant inventory and diner loyalty. Management acknowledged that the single biggest determinant of diners' use of marketplaces is restaurant choice. Historically, Grubhub has chosen only to list partnered restaurants. Due to competitors' decisions to list non-partnered restaurants, diners are finding more restaurants on competing platforms. Given the recent decline in diner loyalty, management are now aggressively moving to invest in eliminating this difference by adding non-partnered restaurants. In the 3 months since the letter's publication, the company has already doubled the number of restaurants on its platform. In addition, Grubhub is ramping up sales staff to quickly turn these restaurants into partners. Finally, Grubhub will invest in restaurant-funded diner loyalty programs to improve diner stickiness and address the recent trend of diners splitting wallet share. They do not intend to run ephemeral promotions and price discounts. Is this accelerated investment offensive or defensive? We think both. The decision to lean in at this time rather than harvest maintenance profits was determined not only by these recent trends, but also the rising pressure on Grubhub's competitors to demonstrate profitability to their owners. There is no change in views regarding the size of the addressable market nor the proposition gap between platforms and single restaurant digital delivery mechanisms and offline ordering. But the letter cautions against extrapolating the explosive pace of growth over the last few years, a pace of growth enabled by supply-side innovations which have largely played out, i.e. Uber leveraging logistics assets and DoorDash adding unpartnered restaurants. We suspect this dose of reality was aimed as much at the owners of Uber and DoorDash as Grubhub's own shareholders. These events do not challenge our original observation that there was no evidence demonstrating causality between profitability and competitive tension reported by short sellers and the financial press. It was this confusion from which we believed owners of Grubhub could profit. Reported customer acquisition costs and gross food sales per cohort were stable. Accelerated investments since 4Q18 were offensive. They resulted in a trebling of net diner additions and no inflation in CACs. However, management is now implying that indeed since August the LTV is trending down due to lower diner loyalty, a trend which will cost money to address. Since the company's letter, it's easy to get caught in the minutiae and try to triangulate pieces of data to gain insights that don't move the needle. Big picture, we think Grubhub still has a defensible position. Grubhub's moat lies in barriers to entry rather than competitive differentiation. However, we do believe that Grubhub's management has the most appropriate strategic priorities and the richest insight into the economic dynamics of online food, demand generation, good, point-to-point hot food delivery, bad. As such, their investment efforts are directed to restaurant loyalty tools versus episodic and unsustainable discounting. Grubhub also has the largest partnered network, meaning a more durably positive experience for restaurants, diners, and drivers. It has always been our premise that a very small number of players will enjoy the economic fruits of an inevitable trend, given the proposition difference of digital ordering versus paper menus and individual restaurant digital ordering solutions. There may be periods of accelerated competition as each player does seem to believe that being the biggest is important. But the most relevant competitor, the old way of doing things, is the least discussed. Barriers to profitable participation are high. We don't see any new evidence to contest that. Switching costs are more modest and less tangible than a brand, marketing scale efficiencies and two-sided network. But they include, 1, an inherently profitable, marketplace model. 80% of Grubhub's restaurants are independent SMEs who value demand generation highly. Grubhub adds more than 5 partnered independent restaurants for every additional large brand QSR location. 40% of orders are delivery, which is a cost-plus model and offered only to improve inventory and therefore the strength of the marketplace profit center. Contrast with the lack of profitable scalability of competitors' delivery-first, variable-cost, point-to-point, QSR-heavy, B2C business model. This is not hub-and-spoke nor B2B delivery, both of which allow for the stacking of orders and delivery from one location to multiple customers. 2. The largest partnered network. This enables the lowest prices to the diner, who is not covering the entire cost of the service through menu markups. 3. Level up / integration with restaurants and the ability to offer them white label websites and run loyalty programs. What is the current reality? Industry commentators share an obsession with aggregate market share in a three-player industry with local network effects and a huge, potentially underestimated, addressable market. The digital migration may be less rapid, because there are no longer the innovation leaps to accelerate it. There are clear barriers to entry but unclear switching costs. This was always the case, despite the evidence of diner loyalty. Consolidation makes sense, has happened in the US and is happening elsewhere. There has been substantial capitulation. Management is smart, thoughtful, and candid. Post the sell-off, the company could be purchased for 10 times its maintenance earnings. which it can grow at a minimum pace of double digits for a long time. Trailing 12 months of revenues equals $1.3 billion, less non-discretionary cash costs of ops/support, tech and G&A of $900 million equals $430 million, $340 million after tax. A 13x owner earnings multiple. There is now greater uncertainty over whether we can assume 40% as a normal margin for the marketplace business. Despite the well-adjusted language management uses to describe the challenges of this industry, they expect that the business could generate $2 EBITDA/order absent their investment initiatives. This supports a 40% marketplace margin assumption. So does a comparison of mature international marketplaces. So does the income statement normalization exercise above. If so, and as delivery is a cost-plus undertaking, the company traded on high single digits of normal EBITDA after the third quarter results. We think that if diner loyalty is genuinely and sustainably lower, it seems more likely now that the oligopoly will further consolidate into two players. We responded to this extreme stock volatility by averaging down quite meaningfully at $35/share, Grubhub remains a core investment holding. The value of independent thought. Responsibility to yourself means refusing to let others do your thinking, talking, and naming for you. It means learning to respect and use your own brains and instincts, hence, grappling with hard work. Adrienne Rich. The booming digital distribution of opinions has increased the value of independent thinking to investment decision makers. Those who read news and views on social media are consuming tailored versions of events and stories to suit their specific tastes and political, economic, and social ideals. These messages are designed to hold our attention so that we may be sold advertising messages. They are not designed to help us calibrate our attitude and improve our judgment, for which there is no social media business case. Our worldview becomes more embedded by confirmation bias endemic to the social media echo chamber. Forming opinions by examining facts, logic, and data is old-fashioned and effortful compared to listening to talking heads and internet commentators telling us where to stand on any issue we care to imagine. Market participants with higher confidence and lower accuracy are what fund managers able to think independently should wish to compete against. Regurgitation of others' opinions or the capacity for such opinions to shake our own beliefs due to inadequate independent research are symptomatic of an unexamined life and a hindrance to a successful career. Bad decisions are inevitably the consequence of ineffective thinking. Our investment holdings may from time to time be controversial and divide opinion. A very long-term horizon is most valuable when others are throwing in the towel. At any one time, it is likely that some of our companies are knocking it out of the park, and others are grappling with hard business problems they are well placed to ultimately solve. For those who deserve it, we will support them with patient capital. Wishing you a healthy and happy year ahead. Yours sincerely, Mark.